Never mind.
Having a nice time?
Not especially. Bit too much company.
That's unusual.
Yes. I think they're just local people, not the rival firm.
What do you want to do?
Oh, it would be a shame to cut my trip short, I suppose.
Yes.
I'll carry on then.
If you're happy.
Thanks.
Good luck.
I put the phone down. Lucas had gone back to London. I wondered what that meant. I decided it was the Americans who were tailing me, just a couple of local FBI agents checking up. They liked to keep tabs on us. Nothing too worrying, and I could lose them easily. I felt an intense physical longing for Lucas. Perhaps I should turn back, take a train to New York, wait for him there, and when he came back, tell him... I took the train to Santa Fe, last leg of the journey. I would carry on with the mission. It was, without exception, the worst mistake I ever made in my life.
Restless by William Boyd was dramatised for radio by Melissa Murray and starred Eileen Atkins, Fenella Woolgar, Adrian Lucas, Akbar Kurta, Matt Addis, Jean Goodman, Malcolm Tierney, Sam Dale, Benjamin Askew, Philip Fox, Jonathan Taffler and Lizzie Watts. The director was Mark Beebe.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
On a whim, an American tycoon buys a hotel and is thrown into a world of Edwardian espionage and murder when John Sessions stars in The Grand Babylon Hotel by Arnold Bennett at 3 o'clock. Before that, the final episode of Now All Roads Lead to France. Thomas says a final farewell to his friends and family in early 1917 and leaves for France just as his first collection of poems nears publication. The reader is Tobias Menzies.
The war was less than 2 years old, Edward Thomas's own war almost a year, and he began a poem on the 27th of May with the working title of The Last Team. By the time he had finished it, he had taken a step towards his decision to seek a commission on the front line. The poem he wrote may not have been a conventional war poem, but the war touched every part of it. As the team's head brass. As the team's head brass flashed out on the turn, the lovers disappeared into the wood. I sat among the boughs of the fallen elm that strewed an angle of the fallow, and watched the plough narrowing a yellow square of charlock. Every time the horses turned, instead of treading me down, the ploughman leaned upon the handles to say or ask a word, about the weather, next about the war. Scraping the share, he faced towards the wood and screwed along the furrow till the brass flashed once more. The blizzard felled the elm whose crest I sat in by a woodpecker's round hole, the ploughman said. When will they take it away? When the war's over. So the talk began. 1 minute and an interval of 10. A minute more and the same interval. Have you been out? No. If I could only come back again, I should. I could spare an arm. I shouldn't want to lose a leg. If I should lose my head, why so? I should want nothing more. Have many gone from here? Yes. Many lost? Yes, a good few. Only 2 teams work on the farm this year. One of my mates is dead. The second day in France they killed him. It was back in March. The very night of the blizzard, too. Now, if he had stayed here, we should have moved the tree. And I should not have sat here. Everything would have been different, for it would have been another world. Aye, and a better, though. If we could see all might seem good. Then the lovers came out of the wood again. The horses started, and for the last time I watched the clods crumble and topple over after the ploughshare and the stumbling team. If we could see all, Thomas had written, all might seem good. Here the speaker had understood something invaluable, had realized what was wrong with the scene in which he sat, that the world he enjoyed was contingent upon those who were willing to fight for it. It was somewhere around this time, said Eleanor Fargin, that she pressed Thomas on precisely why he chose to enlist. He was said to pause, bend down to scoop a handful of soil from around his shoe, and say, literally, for this. Within 8 weeks of writing this poem, Thomas had committed himself to service overseas. I offered myself for artillery, and today I was accepted. After months of panic and uncertainty, I feel much happier. On the 20th of October, Thomas sent his wife Helen a set of the verses which he was preparing for publication with Selwyn and Blount. "Don't send to Frost before I tell you that the thing is settled," he urged. Frost, meanwhile, had published his third collection, Mountain Interval. It opened with "The Road Not Taken," typeset in italics to suggest a governing tone for the book. Thomas was no longer reviewing. His attentions were now almost entirely military. "I might very well be in France before Christmas," he wrote to Frost. "I hope so." From Trowbridge he wrote "Lights Out," a poem that he said sums up what I have often thought of that call, though no reader could mistake its deeper undercurrent. Here is Helen Thomas in later life reading "Lights Out."
"I have come to the borders of sleep, the unfathomable deep forest where all must lose their way, however straight or winding, soon or late they cannot choose. There is not any book or face of dearest look that I would not turn from now. To go into the unknown, I must enter and leave alone, I know not how. The tall forest towers, its cloudy foliage lowers ahead, shelf above shelf. Its silence I hear and obey, that I may lose my way and myself."
On the weekend of the 6th and 7th of January 1917, Thomas was at his home at Highbeach for the last time before he left for France. Friends arrived to say their goodbyes, Eleanor Fargin among them. At the top of the stairs, Fargin and Thomas kissed goodnight. "Strong as it was," she wrote, "and for me so very deep, our friendship had remained undemonstrative from beginning to end." He read stories to Bronwyn and studied maps with Mervyn and told each of them to be kind to their mother while he was away. But between Edward and Helen, the kindness was not so easily manageable. He was terse as he reminded her about their life assurance and other documents he thought she might one day need, and they bickered about trivialities. The last day he might have had with Helen, he spent in London. He had a dental check and saw some literary friends before returning. With his luggage standing in the hall, the enormity of the situation seemed too much to speak of. He pressed upon her the need, should he not return, for hired help to dig in the potatoes. Helen could no longer rein back her desperation and felt engulfed by an uncontrollable grief. She would recount his tenderness in that moment. He read to her and carried her to the bedroom in his greatcoat. "Helen, Helen," he had said, "remember that whatever happens, all is well between us forever and ever." When the morning came, she stood at the gate and watched him disappear into the mist and snow. The sorrow of true love is a great sorrow, and true love parting blackens a bright morrow. Yet almost they equal joys, since their despair is but hope blinded by its tears, and clear above the storm, the heavens wait to be seen. The men of 244 Siege Battery rose at 5 o'clock on the 29th of January. By 6:30, they were marching from Codford through the frost, singing Pack Up Your Troubles in the darkness. Edward Thomas said to hear the men sing the rotten song with such gusto brought a tear to his eye. The train to Southampton was perishingly cold, but delivered them to the docks by 9:30. It was a tumbling crossing, but the arrival at Le Havre was restful and unforgettable. At sunrise, they marched through fields full of cotton bales and falling snow. They arrived at camp at 9:45 a.m. Thomas wrote to Eleanor Fargin to ask after the progress of his book proofs and to make sure that she had not omitted the dedication to Robert Frost. The battery spent almost a week in Le Havre before moving up to a position near the cathedral town of Arras. Each morning, Thomas's duty was to identify an observation post from which he might survey the German lines. Not a living thing came into view on the first day. Only a snowy, broken land with posts and wires and dead trees. His 39th birthday came and went without any post. Thomas wrote that he no longer wanted anything, consciously, except, I suppose, the end. I should like to be a poet, just as I should like to live, but I know as much about my chances in either case, and I don't really trouble about either. Only, I want to come back more or less complete. No sooner had Thomas mailed this off than another came in the post. Helen had forwarded a letter that she had received from Frost. I have found a publisher for his poems in America, Frost declared. It was extraordinary news. The poet, who had come so recently to his trade, and who had met with one rejection after another from English editors, was to have his debut published in both Britain and America. So you did find a publisher after all, I have just heard, Thomas replied. And that was it. No thank you, no euphoria, and only a passing mention in his diary. On Good Friday, Edward Thomas read a review from the TLS of An Anthology of New Poetry, which carried 18 of Thomas's poems under the name of Edward Easterway. He is a real poet, with the truth in him. Robert Frost said this, His poetry is so very brave, so unconsciously brave. He didn't think of it for a moment as war poetry, though that is what it is. It ought to be called Roads to France. Saturday, April 7th or 8th. Arras. Dearest, here I am in my valise on the floor of my dugout writing before sleeping. The artillery is like a stormy tide breaking on the shores of the full moon. I watch the shells changing the landscape. The pretty village among trees that I first saw 2 weeks ago is now just ruins among violated, stark tree trunks. Edward Thomas spent the day before he died under particularly heavy bombardment. The shell that fell 2 yards from where he stood should have killed him, but instead it was a rare dud. Back at billet, the men teased him on his lucky escape. Someone remarked that a fellow with Thomas's luck should be safe wherever he went. Mafanwy Thomas was embroidering a wild duck onto a postcard to send to her daddy when the telegraph boy drew up outside the house. Helen read the message in silence while he waited for her reply. No answer, she eventually said. On the last pages of his war diary, Edward Thomas wrote, I never understood quite what was meant by God, and in pencil the following three lines. Where any turn may lead to heaven, or any corner may hide hell. Roads shining like river uphill after rain. Robert Frost wrote to Helen in condolence. I want to see him to tell him something. I want to tell him what I think he liked to hear from me, that he was a poet.
That final part of Now All Roads Lead to France was read by Tobias Menzies. It was abridged by Richard Hamilton and produced by Emma Harding. And at 3:15 on Monday afternoon, Sir Alec Guinness reads from My Name Escapes Me, one of his memoirs.
Inspiration.
I had this dream about heads on wheels.
Hard work.
He's the ace. He's amazing. And that's how it all started. Messing around on a mandolin in the flat here in Manchester.
And creative ways to save money.
All you see on screen is kind of three eyes blinking in the darkness. And that's radically inexpensive.
Remembering the studio that was home to Danger Mouse, Count Duckula and Chorlton and the Wheelies.
It was weird, that's what it was.
Yeah, that's why I liked it, I suppose.
Crikey DM, David Jason's tribute to Cosgrove Hall. This Saturday morning at 10:30 over on BBC Radio 4.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello, this is Jim Lee at 3 o'clock, and that's the time for the 60-minute drama where John Sessions is the star of an Arnold Bennett romantic thriller. In the 4 o'clock show, Mel Gedroych visits Edinburgh Zoo's star attraction, the Giant Pandas, and introduces the final chapter in Bruce Coville's My Teacher is an Alien. And later, a menacing assignment awaits the student sorcerer Arkos. The Heart of Harkoon, Peter and Jamie Thompson's fantasy adventure starring Trevor Peacock, is in the 7th Dimension at 6 o'clock. Now, on a whim, an American tycoon buys the Grand Babylon Hotel and is thrown into a world of intrigue, espionage and murder.
What's happening to me? Oh God, I'm dying.
Arnold Bennett's The Grand Babylon Hotel, Part 2.
Help me.
In Part 1, American railroad magnate Theodore Wraxall and his daughter Nella cross the Atlantic to stay at London's Grand Babylon Hotel, a hotel of legendary exclusivity.
See the black door? That's the east entrance, only for royalty. It's a noose every day.
Nella Wraxall is a young woman who likes to get what she wants. And to celebrate her birthday...
I know exactly what I want. Fillet of steak and a bottle of Bass beer.
Faced with an obstinate head waiter...
Jules, the compliments of Monsieur Rocco. He will be unable to serve steak and Bass tonight.
Wraxall behaves with characteristic recklessness and buys the hotel from Felix Babylon.
I will sell the hotel to you for £400,000 and one guinea.
But things are not what they seem at the Grand Babylon, and Wraxall and Nella are soon embroiled in mystery, betrayal, and murder.
His heart stopped. He's dead.
Nella tries to solve the mysterious disappearance of Grand Duke Eugen with the help of Prince Aribert. While Wraxall discovers that Jules is not what he seems, Nella rashly traces one of the conspirators, Miss Spencer, to a house in Ostend and questions her at gunpoint. But Nella is too bold for her own good and is outwitted by the lethal Miss Spencer.
What are you doing to me?
Oh, sorry. I should have said. I'm rolling up the sleeve of your dress. I'm going to give you an injection. Here comes the needle. Good night.
The Grand Babylon Hotel, Part 2.
The
cold, tickling. The needle. Black shoes. Glossy black. Miss Spencer's black shoes. Last thing I saw. The cold, tickling. It's bright and I'm rocking. Water. A boat. Yes. I'm on a boat. Think. Never. A yacht. Sails not set, so we're under steam. Doing about 7 or 8 knots. Think, Nella. Now, here's another boat, a paddle steamer. I could get help. First thing, wave at them and... Oh, I'm tied up. Who is it? I can't turn. Damn you.
Beautiful morning, isn't it, Miss Raxall?
Sure. Or do you prefer...